You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, China attempts to demonstrate to the world that its anti-corruption crusade is serious and that the state of its economy isn't. My guests, Isabel Hilton and Michael Binion, will be here to scrutinise the runes from Beijing. Later in the show, we'll look at Russia, which is not only building a new military base, interestingly close to its border with Ukraine, but stepping up its involvement in the civil war in Syria. We'll be asking where Moscow is going with this, and whether there's much point in trying to stop it. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. My guest singular today so far is Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times. Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue Net, will hopefully be joining us imminently. We'll start by taking a look at Russia, Michael. It is now slightly more than 18 months since, according at least to the official Kremlin view of events, Russia most certainly did not invade Ukraine. Since then, of course, Russia absolutely hasn't sent troops and tanks into the neighbouring country, definitely hasn't fomented insurrection in the east of the country, had nothing to do with the troops and tanks which somehow manifested in the region, and was categorically uninvolved with the shooting down of a civilian airliner which overflew the conflict for which Russia was never responsible. Now, Russia appears to be not building a substantial military base near the border with Ukraine. Michael, can we infer from all this complete non-activity by Russia that Russia is categorically disinterested in Ukraine for the long haul?
Well, certainly if you build a military base just a few miles from the border, it suggests that you do have some interest in what's going on across the border. And the reports are very substantial of a massive military base being built just north of the Ukrainian border, not actually near the area where the fighting is going on, but to the...
Well, perish the thought. Why would that be indeed, of any interest to
indeed,
them?
Indeed. But, you know, a base is a base in the region. Curiously, though, it actually coincides with a period that's been relatively calm. In the last week or so, there haven't been very many incidents. And this has coincided with an interesting piece of gossip that's been going on. Well, not gossip, but speculation, in that one of the proposed solutions for Ukraine might be what they call Finlandization. Now, this was something that they used in the Cold War. It was the idea of friendly Finland, which kept its Western way of life, had a deal with Russia whereby they never criticised Russia, they never opposed Russian policy, they never did anything to annoy Russia, but they were left alone. And for the Finns, it worked. Both countries have got a very similar history in a way. Both were part of the Russian Empire. Finland, after all, was before 1917. Both fought a war against Russia, both lost chunks of territories, and both have to live with a giant neighbour.
Finland, of course, has kept out of NATO as well, which is part of that,
right,
that deal with Russia. Although Finland has, interestingly enough, in light of Russia's misadventures in Ukraine, there's been some discussion in Finland about reconsidering staying out of NATO.
Well, Finland has been pretty robust. The idea that this country just rolled over and supinely gave in to everything Russia said is not true. They never criticised in public, but in private they were vicious towards the Russians if they felt Russia was pushing too hard. This is during communist times.
Indeed, and so. Now they having previously stood up for themselves fairly commendably during the Winter War as well.
Indeed. Well, now they are a bit more robust in public as well. So I think the Finns do have backbone. And it would be a solution, certainly for a while, for Ukraine. Although the problem is, Ukraine is so split amongst itself that I'm not sure that it would work.
Well, this base, we are now joined by Isabel Hilton from China Dialogue Net. Welcome to the show, Isabel. You mentioned there that as this immense Russian base is being built in Ukraine, things in Ukraine have recently been relatively quiet, which is the case. Is it possible that is because we've reached the point at which Russia has pretty much got what it wanted from the Ukraine crisis? It has now, it's a situation not dissimilar to Georgia. It has this presence in the country, it has a stick with which it can poke the capital whenever it feels like it, and its presence there means that country will never, ever, ever get anywhere near joining the EU or NATO.
Well, I think that's a pretty good assessment. Yes, I think that's about where we are. Echoes back to Finland. Stalin got what he wanted when he beat the Finns finally after the Winter War. And Finland never challenged Russia again. Ukraine is never going to be in a position to challenge Russia militarily, because if they did, again, they would lose. And the president knows that very well. That's why he's been trying to put through proposals for autonomy for the rebel regions, effectively letting them go.
Isabel, we have been discussing this very, very hefty base Russia is now constructing along its border with Ukraine, while Russia, of course, continues to deny that it has anything whatsoever to do with the fighting just on the other side of the border. Is this base, I guess, to what extent is it actually a strategic necessity from Russia's point of view, and to what extent is it a large and expensive symbol of them just reminding Ukraine and everybody who takes an interest in Ukraine that we're right here?
Well, I think one shouldn't underestimate the demonstration effect. It's very popular in Russia. The unpalatable truth that this expedition has been hugely good for Putin's ratings at a time when he's not delivering very much else, when his economy's in trouble, the oil price is low and all that. So I think that to go on giving the impression of a strong Russia, building a military base which is going to infuriate all the NATO members and the neighbours, but they can do nothing about it. And it also says to Obama, you really don't have a policy for Russia or the Ukraine.
But hasn't that been, just to follow that up, this is how it strikes me, at least, that has been the sentiment underpinning the entire Russian adventure in Ukraine and Crimea. We will do as we damn well please, and we won't be told otherwise.
Well, I think that's right. But to build a physical base there is really, it's very in your face in terms of saying, we're not even pretending anymore, are we? We're building a shiny new base. You can do nothing about it. Our soldiers will be there.
Actually technically in Russia, so of course...
Indeed it is.
But it's not being built to defend Russia from invasion from Ukraine,
well,
is it?
No, it's... Well, they are specifically saying, in case of a threat. And they're actually suggesting, NATO forces might one day rally around Ukraine and pose a threat to Russia.
Just a final thought from each of you before we look at another military intervention which Russia is officially not making. We were talking earlier, shortly before you arrived, Isabel, about the idea of this frozen conflict along the Georgian model that Russia has now established in Ukraine. Is it frozen? Is there, and I'll ask you first, Michael, is there any reason to imagine that 5-10 years from now it will look terribly much different?
I don't think it will, no. I don't think the Russians actually want to own that bit of Ukraine. It would be very expensive to take it over formally. It's sort of de facto now part of Russia in that they've just swapped currencies and officially use the ruble, so it's linked to Russia. But if they actually take over the whole infrastructure, they would be responsible for things like pensions and all that. It would cost a great deal.
All that boring stuff like collecting the rubbish once a week.
They've got to do that in Crimea, and it costs them a fortune. And I don't think, therefore, that there's going to be any sort of real change of borders. I think Ukraine will have to live with the situation as it is. And in a way, they may come to some kind of modus vivendi if the Minsk agreement can be made to stick, and if extremists on both sides can be put back in the box. And I have to say, the extremists on the Ukrainian side are pretty militant still.
Indeed,
they're all
so.
For going out and shelling everything they can see.
Isabel, your thoughts on this? Is this a fact of life now, this strange little, almost Republika Srpska-like presence inside Ukraine, this weird, obdurate little Russian rump?
Absolutely, I agree with Michael. I think that Ukraine will be very lucky to stop there, actually. And I think that is the best they can hope for.
Okay, well, as we have been alluding to, Ukraine is not the only country in which Russian troops have obviously not at all involved themselves in the last few years. Russia has also been very much not involved in Syria, providing no help whatsoever to its old ally Bashar al-Assad, except, of course, that the Russian military build-up in Syria has recently become so overt that even Russia is now struggling to deny it. Michael, first of all, Russia are claiming it's just advisers, which is something America said about Vietnam for an awful long time as well.
And Central America,
and actually several other places besides. It does all get a bit stones and glass houses when everybody starts accusing each other of meddling in other sovereign states. But what do we know for sure about the level of Russia's involvement in Syria now?
Well, Russia is clearly deeply involved militarily, has been right from the start. They have a large naval base at Tartus, which for them is absolutely vital.
This is a warm water port, as they were called.
Now, there is the suggestion that the large naval build-up is actually to protect their interests should Assad fall. It doesn't look as though it would make a decisive difference to whether Assad wins or loses, and at the moment he is still losing. And I think the Russians are quite realistic about this. They don't really care if Assad himself goes. They haven't really, he's not a sort of bosom friend and their ideological soulmate. They do want, though, to keep a regime that is not Islamist out of Syria. They want to protect their interests. They want to have a big say on what happens in the future. And they are actually, I have more sympathy for the Russian point of view about what to do about Syria than a number of Western governments do in their knee-jerk reaction saying the Russians are simply messing it all up.
Well, indeed so. And Isabel, this week especially, Russia's been given a fairly severe wigging on this front by both NATO and the United States. But could Russia, and it is kind of weird, especially against the last few years, to find yourself kind of seeing that Moscow might have half a point. Do they have a case that, frankly, they have as much rights to meddle with Syria as anybody else?
Well, you could well say so. But it's also that they are offering an alliance which is unlikely to be accepted with Western powers to support anyone but ISIS. And given that there are very few what you might call good guys in any of these conflicts, in this now increasingly messy arc of conflict, I don't see that there's very much to choose between the Russian proposition and the United States proposition. As Michael says, Assad's territory is shrinking down to almost nothing. I don't know who the Russian candidate is at this point, but presumably they are scanning the field for someone that they might support. And I think that everyone should be scanning the field for someone that they might support in this conflict. But it's, at the moment, chaos and confusion.
Well, I mean, obviously, if Europe was at all confused about the consequences of chaos in Syria, Europe's been instructed fairly briskly in the reality of that in the last few weeks, especially. On that subject, though, of people picking a side to support and stuff, and I'll put this to you, Michael, if you look at Syria from as detached, even cynical, a real politic point of view as possible, might it be arguable that it actually, at this point, it kind of doesn't matter who it is. Someone just needs to win.
Well, yes, either they need to win, which I don't think is going to be possible, or they need to come to a draw and they need to agree, okay, we just have a draw. And that is the original proposal for a negotiated solution. I mean, there's so much blood spilt, so much bitterness, that nothing seems to have got anywhere with a negotiated solution. But don't forget, it was the Russians who proposed to bring everyone to Geneva, bang their heads together, and try to get them to work with each other. The problem was that the Americans were not prepared to have Iran sitting there as one of the partners. Well, now Iran's done a deal with America on a different issue. It does seem a bit illogical to say, you keep out, even though Iran has a large number of troops in Syria. In the end, both sides will probably fight each other to complete exhaustion, and then somebody will have to think of a solution that isn't military.
Isabel, is as you were saying earlier, that the Russian intervention in Crimea and Ukraine has been colossally popular with Russian people. How patient are they likely to be with the idea of their boys coming back from Syria, dead or injured?
Less so, I would think. I don't think that is something that is going to resonate very much in the heartland. And I'm sure that Russia will be fairly careful about that.
And just, I guess, a final thought on this one before we take a look at China. Michael, you mentioned there earlier Russia's obvious interest in Syria, which is the base at Tartus. Is it just that? Is there anything else underpinning their, so far at least, loyalty and support for Assad?
Oh, yes, indeed, because they see Assad as a bulwark against Islamism. They are terrified of the influence of Islamists on their southern flank. And they're not without cause in worrying about that, because Chechnya is far from stabilised. There is radicalisation going along all throughout the Caucasus region and beyond, even into Tatarstan in the heartland of Russia. And they feel that Assad, by running a regime that was pretty intolerant of any kind of Islamist activities. His father, after all, massacred 20,000 people who were Islamists in 1982.
At Homs, yes.
Indeed. Yeah. And Hama.
It was a little, sorry, yes.
Well, I mean, it could have been anywhere because, you know, he was going after the Islamists wherever. And the Russians feel that that is a very important barrier to the spread of what they also are deeply worried about, just like the West, namely an Islamism that's extreme and out of control.
Isabel, again, we'll move on to China shortly, but just extrapolating from that thought, is it... I'm trying to fashion a kind of like I'd like to teach the world to sing scenario out of the Syrian civil war here, but is it not impossible that basically Russia and the West could end up on the same side in this conflict?
Well, you might think theoretically, but I think that certainly at present, I think it would be an extremely difficult step for Obama to take to appear to be in concert with Russia. Almost anywhere, but particularly in the Middle East. I think it's just for domestic political reasons. I think it would be extraordinarily difficult.
Because they're already fighting
rationally, yes.
They're already fighting on pretty much the same side as Iran in Iraq.
Well, indeed, but rationally, yes. But you can imagine what Donald Trump would make of it. And this is not a trivial remark, unfortunately.
But of course, they are on the same side over the Israel-Palestine thing, because Russia's part of the so-called quartet, along with the United States, United Nations, and the EU, and they're meant to be all working together on that one. I mean, it really is. It just shows the kaleidoscope of complexities in that region. You know, your friend of your friend is not necessarily a friend. Your enemy of your enemy is maybe a friend or an enemy.
Who was an enemy yesterday could be your best hope tomorrow.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is basically the closing scene from Blazing Saddles. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Michael Binion. When we return, we will be looking at China.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
There's a new Monocle book weighing in at 400 pages that's packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. It's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, here with Isabel Hilton and Michael Binion. We'll look now at China and the recurring question of whether Xi Jinping's much ballyhooed crusade against corruption is actually a crusade against corruption or a contraption enabling the whacking of inconvenient political opposition. This has been lent renewed focus by the revelation that a deputy head of the Chinese Communist Party's Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, and they must throw a great Christmas party, dropped in on Interpol during a recent visit to France. Isabel, China being your particular area of expertise, I'm always intrigued when we learn something about China, both how we've learned it and why we've learned it.
Right. So the dropping in of the Central Inspection Commission?
That's the chap. He's been visiting Interpol,
and clearly
he's not shy about us knowing this.
No, indeed. But that's because because a lot of Chinese gentlemen with their sacks of gold, no doubt honestly acquired in pursuit of their public duties, have relocated themselves abruptly abroad. And China wants some of the loot back. China has got a little bit of the loot back. And it wants some of the people back because it wants to, you know, make an example of them. China has some difficulty over this because it doesn't have extradition treaties with a lot of countries, partly because there are some doubts, no doubt quite unfounded, about the integrity of the Chinese judicial system and whether these chaps will get a fair trial.
There's also the absolutely indisputable fact, of course, that you can still get put up against a wall for corruption charges in China.
Indeed you can, yes. And no doubt your trial might fall slightly short of international standards. So it's difficult to hand over, it's difficult to go through those particular motions to hand over what are probably corrupt officials who have fled with, you know, a lot of money. I mean, I don't think that there's any particular doubt about that. What is in question is whether they would be fairly treated when they went back home. But China is now kind of on this mission to prove that it is cleaning up. It wishes, you know, to embarrass anyone who doesn't cooperate with this cleaning up by saying quite clearly that, yeah, we want them back. Aren't you going to help us?
I mean, these officials, we should note, could of course just have been saving their public sector salaries extremely carefully. That can pile up into the billions quite quickly.
Along with a lot of investment genius.
Well, clearly, obviously, savvy investing, etc. Michael, do we have to get to the point of accepting that the anti-corruption drive is actually a serious thing, that the Chinese Communist Party realises that there is a genuine problem?
I think they do realise it. They know it very well, and they also know that this is the one issue on which public opinion will rapidly lose faith in the leadership if they don't see something being done about corrupt officials. This is a thing that infuriates ordinary Chinese more than anybody else. I mean, those that don't have a chance to make themselves rich and to gouge out large sums of money from the public purse, those that don't have a chance are infuriated when they see people doing it. And the fact that these people are clearly members of the party or in some way part of the regime makes it extremely embarrassing for the regime to hold itself up as a sign of moral guidance for the country. So they do need to do something.
That is the Communist Party's great existential terror, isn't it? It's angry mobs in the streets.
Up to a point. I think that they've demonstrated they're pretty good at dealing with angry mobs. I think probably closer to home, Xi Jinping's private worry is, you know, how far he can go in the anti-corruption drive without there being a sort of cabal that knocks on his door late at night and says, your time is up. I don't think the Communist Party is going to be overthrown by mobs in the street. I really don't. And just to go back to your opening question, you know, is this a way of taking down political opponents? Absolutely, yes, it is. Is it a way of attacking sectors that need reform and removing the leadership? Yes, it is. Is it a way of getting the army into line, which you certainly need to do? Yes, it is. 50 senior officers have been cashiered, including a Politburo member who was head of the military procurement. Were they all corrupt? Yes, they were. Are they the only corrupt people in China? Do me a favour. No, they're not. You know, so it's a funny hybrid because it is both things. It is, yes, an anti-corruption drive. And you see, you know, the drop in purchases of luxury watches. You see people leading very sober lives, people going home at night, not doing anything in case they attract attention. But at the same time, you know that systemically, they're not going to change the monopoly of power over the economy and over the politics and over the law that allows this corruption to flourish, because they can't.
You mentioned there, just to follow that up, sort of the fact that Xi Jinping might at some point fear the knock on the door himself. There is an issue, though, isn't there, in that his family are preposterously wealthy, and surely this is generally
thrifty savers.
Well, obviously,
again,
thrifty savers, careful investors, etc. I'm sure it's all entirely laudable and above board, but nonetheless, it's tricky, isn't it?
As well, Wen Jiabao's. You know, I may have said this before, but and one shouldn't take this analogy literally. But you know, when a mafia member goes down, you don't ask if they're a criminal. You ask, how did they lose their protection? Did they think they were bigger than the organization? And it's the same with the Communist Party. When someone goes down for corruption, you don't ask if they were corrupt because everybody assumes they're all corrupt. You ask, how did they get on the wrong side? You know, how did they lose their protection? What's the political message here? That's what people say. And you know, of course, Xi Jinping and the princelings are not going to turn themselves in and say, I've just realized I've got $3 billion in my offshore account, you know, and I must confess, please punish me. That's just not going to happen.
Well, Chinese officials at the moment have, of course, a worry even greater than a caving in of their front door by invigilators from, that name again, the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection. The country's enormous economy has of late been performing less miraculously than previously, as many now shirtless investors in the Shanghai Bourse will confirm. However, Premier Li Keqiang is attempting reassurance, promising the World Economic Forum in Darien that there is no need to start hoarding tinned food and ammunition just yet. Michael, Li says China's economy is shock resistant and resilient. Is he tempting fate on an epic scale here?
Well, it's tempting fate, but I wouldn't say necessarily that in the long run that's untrue. It is a very big economy. It's not going to suddenly, you know, crash. There's not going to be a kind of Wall Street collapse in the same way we've seen. The real problem is the economy is readjusting to much slower growth, and the world is readjusting to the fact that China is not going to be this kind of warehouse or factory for everything the world wants. And not at the price that the world wants it. And I think the reaction in a lot of overseas stock markets has been one of fear, but based on uncertainty, not necessarily on a sort of rational working out of what's the effect in the rest of the world of what's going on in China. And so he's trying to as much reassure people overseas as trying to tell people at home, don't listen to foreign rumours about things all going wrong. It's not as bad as you think.
On that subject, though, and this is always one of the difficulties of the Chinese economy, all these bets people are making in China and elsewhere over the health or otherwise of the Chinese economy. Isabel, the figures on which people are making these bets, really?
No, not at all. he says, look, we're going to meet our targets, and no doubt they will produce figures that say they'll meet the targets. Every other analyst is looking, who's looking at a range of inputs, you know, electricity use, resource use, you know, imports, exports, puts it at around 4%, and the target is 7%. And for the rest of the world, I mean, there are a number of issues here. Li Keqiang may be saying, we are going to keep our domestic economy going. The question is, how are they going to keep the economy going? Because the big program of this government, of this regime, is economic reform. It's making that transition from the big manufacturing economy to the service economy, to the higher value stuff, all of that stuff that you need to do when you get into the middle income range. And the question that has arisen over the performance in the last few weeks is, are they going to be able to do it? Because they were trying to get off big investment. They have a great, you know, weight of debt. And the stock market was one of the ways in which they were supposed to put, you know, be able to find, raise capital to go into enterprise rather than direct state investment. That's on the floor now. If you look at things like the annual report of the European Chamber of Commerce, sounds quite dull. Actually, it's a gripping read. It shows that business confidence...
There's a quote for the cover for them.
Absolutely.
A gripping read, Isabel Hilton.
People who are actually on the ground in China, foreign businesses on the ground in China, have never been more depressed. They're depressed about the performance of the economy. They're also depressed about the kind of market access they get, because as things get tighter in China, the foreigners get squeezed out. So all these people, including the British government, who imagine that somehow Britain's moment will come when finally we get access to services in China, I think are dreaming the wrong dream. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Could I ask, do you think, though, that the Western reaction or the reaction in the rest of the world has been hysterical or as a perfectly reasonable assessment of what's happening in China? And do you think what's happening there is as serious for the West as some analysts here are saying?
Well, I don't think that the stock market crash was serious, except in so far as it demonstrated a very, very peculiar attitude to the market on the part of the government. And it dented what has been a nearly religious belief in the competence of the Chinese technocrat, which many of us have often thought was overblown, but was very prevalent in the business community. And suddenly, you know, that shock was partly what you were seeing when there was a kind of mass panic. It's not that the Shanghai stock market is going to bring down stock markets around the world. It's the fact that, you know, they've then started arresting people and accusing foreigners of all people of malicious short selling and arresting journalists who were writing about it. You thought, really? This is going to be the. I can't, this does not look like an economy that is moving confidently to the market as it needs to.
We will have to leave it there. Isabel Hilton and Michael Binion, thank you both as ever very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Aidan McLaughlin. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, there'll be music from Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours, Ben Ryland is back with The Urbanist at 2200. It's the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.